At this point, I'm living on nothing. I have no hope. I have no future.
A story of frustration and delays for a veteran seeking help. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Juneau Assembly plans for a special mayoral election.
I think there is a desire out there for people to be able to vote on a leadership position.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Increase the earning power with a Bachelor of Business Administration degree with a Human Resource Management emphasis from the UAS School of Management. Details at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP, has laid off 30 employees, citing budget concerns. In a press release, the corporation says general staff will take a 5% salary reduction and senior management will face a 10% salary cut. It's unclear why the layoffs are occurring, but AVCP cited the economy. The release says, quote, during these changing economic times, we have identified the need to reduce costs associated with providing services in our region. The statement says the budget cuts began last week. News staff with KYUK contacted AVCP, but the senior chairperson was not available for an interview. The Veterans Administration in Alaska has made big strides in improving care over the last few years, but people still fall through the cracks. In part one of a two-part story, KSKA's Zachariah Hughes explains how difficult it's been for one ex-Marine to navigate VA care and what's at stake for thousands of veterans coming on the rolls each year.
I first met Scott Harrison on an indoor soccer field in Wasilla back in August. He was one of dozens of veterans who attended a listening session with the Secretary of the VA and spoke about the problems he's had accessing his benefits. Scott was candid about the scale of misfortune that he's faced in his life and with the VA in Alaska.
I've got 6 years of absolute proof positive of the crap that's gone on, the discrimination, being told I'm worthless, being told I should go pay for it myself. I've lost my home. I've had so many surgeries, I can barely walk. From standing in this line for 30 minutes, I will go home tonight. I will lay in bed for 2 or 3 days with pillows between my legs because of all the spinal fusions and damage I have.
I followed up with Scott the next few months to figure out how things could go so wrong. Was it his fault? Was it the VA's fault? Where is the design in so much calamity?
Ow.
The next time I saw Scott was inside the cramped, cluttered one-room cabin he rents off a side road in Big Lake.
Yeah, is that your back?
Yeah, I just got to move a bunch of times, sorry. It's just the nerve damage.
Scott sat cross-legged on the broken hospital bed where he spends most of each day. He rolled cigarettes and showed me scars from different surgeries.
I'll pull it up so you can see. It's pretty...
The basic issue is this. After his service, Scott's leg started freezing up. He'd fall to the ground, unable to get back up. This would happen multiple times a day, but by his 40s, it was getting more severe. He says it's related to an old back injury that first happened when he was in the Marine Corps in the 80s, constructing gun bunkers. There was a problem with the equipment, and Scott fell dozens of feet to the bottom of a pit. Scott says he remembers getting medical treatment for that particular injury, one of the few, because usually he'd grit his teeth and just tough it out.
You know, you're supposed to be Marine tough, and here just, you know, yeah, you've got arterial blood spraying. Here's a Band-Aid. Take an aspirin.
By 2007, doctors were telling Scott he needed urgent medical care, but he couldn't get an appointment at the VA. This was right at the height of the dysfunction for the VA in Alaska before they launched a series of reforms. An inspector general's audit of 16 VA offices across the country in 2009 and 10 ranked the Anchorage regional office as tied for last in standards of care. Meanwhile, Scott's health declined, and he sold off equipment and possessions while a messy property dispute played out in court. By 2013, the VA had Scott scheduled for a surgery to fix cervical discs in his neck, and the plan was to follow that up with a spinal fusion. He had just enough money to make it through recuperation.
Well, that's when we had the government shutdown.
That delayed his next operation, but Scott couldn't work, and the 8-month period between surgeries wiped him out financially. Court records from February of 2014, a few weeks after his spinal fusion, show him facing eviction. And by then, there was another backlog in healthcare appointments at the VA facility. It would be almost a year before he got physical therapy.
Basically, I just laid on a bed in here. I had to be taken out by ambulance several times because my muscles just cramped and locked, and I couldn't even physically get out of the bed.
Scott is somewhat more mobile now, but he's stuck. He's living on about $1,000 a month through Social Security insurance and public assistance. Most of that goes to renting a poorly insulated cabin the size of a tool shed. The stove is torn apart, and even if it weren't, there's not enough counter space for Scott to cook.
At this point, I'm living on nothing. I have no hope. I have no future. I've called the suicide hotline just to have somebody to talk to because sometimes I just go nuts.
Between the pain and the poverty, Scott almost never leaves the cabin. One of the only people he has any kind of relationship with is Diane Williams.
And he's not physically able to get stuff done. I mean, he physically can't do it.
Diane knew Scott's older brother 20 years ago, who, like all of Scott's family, has since died. She saw Scott's name in the paper this summer after his testimony at the VA hearing and reached out to help.
He doesn't even seem like the same person. And that's sad. I mean, he's not that old yet. He should still have life ahead of him. More than what he's got now.
Diane doesn't think many solutions will come from the VA. Her hope is to get Scott into a better house, one where he has more room, can cook for himself, and see a little bit more of the outside world. But all of that depends on unlocking the funds Scott would be entitled to if he can show that his current health crisis is due to the back injury from his Marine days. But according to Scott, that process can't even get off the ground because the VA can't get him a copy of his service records. Tomorrow, we'll find out why. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Fairbanks Daily News Miner is being sold. The newspaper reports that a nonprofit foundation created by the late wife of the paper's founder, Charles W. Snedden, is purchasing the News Miner. The paper's current owner, William Dean Singleton, made the announcement yesterday. Singleton and a partner have owned the paper since purchasing it from Snedden Heirs in 1992. Snedden Foundation trustee Virginia Farmier says the deal, which includes the Kodiak Daily Mirror as well as the News Miner, means the papers will be nonprofits. That means they'll no longer be able to endorse candidates for public office and must demonstrate greater editorial balance. Farmier says no other major changes are planned as a result of the sale, which is expected to close early next year. No price was disclosed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, striking a balance between bears and humans.
We want to always maintain healthy populations, but then we could go anywhere from kind of the bottom level of that to not harvesting any animals and just letting them do what they're going to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Each December, there is a spike in impaired driving-related accidents. Consider the real costs of driving impaired. It could result in the loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
Juneau voters will elect a new mayor during a special election on May 15th, the assembly decided last night. As Deputy Mayor Mary Becker succeeded Mayor Greg Fisk when he died November 30th, whoever wins the March special election will serve the rest of Fisk's three-year term, which ends October 2018. Assemblymember Lauren Jones made the motion to have a special election for mayor. Member Kate Troll supported it and said the city can afford the estimated $35,000 cost.
This was a leadership position. Mayor Fisk was elected with a strong show of support on all the precincts. So I think there is a desire out there for people to be able to vote on a leadership position. And I also believe that it is a way of making all of us, including the community, move on through this difficult time.
Members Jerry Nankervis and Debbie White oppose the motion. Both said in past similar situations, the assembly did not hold a special election. White added, a special election would be a waste of time and money.
I don't even know that we're going to get any kind of a turnout having an election in March. And the fact is that only about 20% of the voters even bother to show up anyway. Maybe if they're denied the opportunity this time, they'll show up in October.
The motion passed 5-3 with Becker, Nankervis, and White voting no. A new mayor could be sworn in any time after the election is certified on March 22nd. Becker says she does not plan to run for mayor in the special election. Jones' motion to hold an election also directed staff to prepare an ordinance that ensures Becker would return to her District 1 seat when a new mayor takes office. In the meantime, the Assembly is accepting applications through January 5th to temporarily fill the District 1 seat. Earlier in the meeting, the Assembly selected member Jesse Keel to serve as deputy mayor. Anchorage police say a dispute during a drug transaction preceded the shooting deaths of two men Monday on the city's west side. Police at 12:30 a.m. took calls reporting shots fired and a vehicle chasing another on West Tudor Road. Police found the body of 22-year-old Jeremiah Taluga near railroad tracks west of Spinard Builders Supply. 20 minutes later, 33-year-old Robin Porter died of a gunshot wound at an Anchorage hospital. His wife, 31-year-old Megan Porter, told police she and her husband had met with Taluga to sell him drugs. A dispute broke out and all three fired shots. Megan Porter is being held on suspicion of second-degree murder, manslaughter, and drug misconduct. Police are seeking the driver of the vehicle in which Taluga arrived. A suspect has been identified and charged in a recent stabbing death in the capital city, but another stabbing death remains unsolved. It's been more than a year since Juneau man Christopher Kenny died from a knife wound. The 50-year-old was found in his home 2 days after Thanksgiving last year, and police still aren't sure if it was a murder or a suicide. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
When Chris Kenny died, his brother Rob Kenny and a few friends made a video slideshow of his life. It's filled with old family photos of when they're kids.
He's in the green.
Of their home in Pelican.
Our house was always full of kids all the time.
There are pictures of giant halibut and king salmon towering over the brothers as kids. Their dad was a commercial fisherman, and the brothers spent a lot of their childhood on a boat.
He was such a hard worker, man. He worked so hard. Even when we were little kids, he was really hard worker.
In the pictures of Kenny as an adult, he's always with one or more of his kids. He had three, a daughter in her 20s and two school-aged children. Rob Kenny says his brother devoted himself to raising his two young kids.
Sometimes I forget he's gone and want to call him and ask him, hey, can you go help mom? You know, she's called me and I can't get over there. And I'm like, oh, shoot. You know, so that makes it hard.
Kenny was born May 18th, 1964 in Juneau and raised in Pelican and Washington State. After high school, he worked on commercial fishing boats. He was a wood and ivory carver and won ribbons for his art at Alaska State Fairs. Lieutenant David Campbell says Juneau police are investigating Kenny's death as a homicide, but he says they don't know enough to call it a murder, which requires intent. Around 5:30 a.m. on November 29, 2014, Juneau police received a 911 call that a man had been injured with a knife in a Greening Park apartment. The 911 call came from a 26-year-old woman who Rob Kenny says was his brother's living girlfriend. Campbell says the knife they believe was used in the stabbing was found in the apartment, and police have it. More than a year later, police are still trying to piece together what happened.
What we know is that he had been stabbed, but what exactly led up to the stabbing or why he was stabbed or who he was stabbed or whether he stabbed himself are still yet to be determined.
The state medical examiner's report says the cause of death was a stab wound, but it leaves the manner of death as undetermined. Kenny's brother, Rob Kenny, writes off the suicide theory.
He was such a positive person. There was no way he was going to stab himself. There was just no way that he thought that way on the account of his kids for the biggest reason.
Besides the Kenny homicide, Campbell says four detectives are working on three other homicide cases, a shooting in October, a double shooting in November, and a stabbing earlier this month. Arrests have been made in two of these cases. No charges have been made on the Kenny case, and Campbell says police might never get to that point. He says the department continues to chase leads concerning one person of interest. He anticipates things coming to a head within 2 months.
There are certain things that the detective is hoping to do, very specific things they're hoping to do. And if it turns out that those things, you know, wrap up relatively soon, then he'll probably either, you know, get charges or move into the cold case, depending on which way those last couple things break. I mean, the lion's share of the work has been done, but some of the really key questions are still floating out there that we're hoping that the last little bit of follow-up will reveal to us.
Campbell notes local police have 3 cold case homicides, Cindy Elrod in 1983, John Jack in 1988, and Daniel Brooks in 2000. Rob Kenny says he and his mom are tired of calling Juneau police and hearing no new developments.
Patience is a hard thing to do when you're reminded of it with small children that miss their dad.
He feels constantly unsettled, not knowing how his brother died.
I would like to gather my family and his children and at least put closure to it, spread his ashes. The ashes sit over there.
Rob Kenny points to a small table stand near the kitchen. He doesn't want to spread the ashes until he knows who killed his brother. He says his parents are getting older, and before they're gone, he hopes to be able to tell them that justice has been served. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Western Alaska's Port Clarence is one small step closer to serving as the nation's Arctic deep draft port. In a press release, Senator Lisa Murkowski announced the Senate passed the Point Spencer Land Conveyance Act. Murkowski said the act would streamline future infrastructure development and potential uses of Point Spencer. Point Spencer is the spit of land that shields Port Clarence Bay from the Bering Sea. The natural deep water port is about 120 nautical miles northwest of Nome. For nearly 50 years, Point Spencer was home to a Coast Guard facility and airstrip. The facility was decommissioned in 2010. The Land Conveyance Act was originally introduced by Murkowski in May with support from both Senator Dan Sullivan and Congressman Don Young. Through land transfers, the act is intended to establish a public-private partnership between Bering Straits Native Corporation and the state of Alaska. While the Coast Guard will retain their footprint at Point Spencer, the federal government will transfer approximately 2,500 acres of land to local, state, and federal stakeholders. The act also established the Port Coordination Advisory Council for the port of Point Spencer. According to the legislation, the council will help coordinate infrastructure development and operations at the port. The Point Spencer Land Conveyance Act was included in the Coast Guard Authorization Act, which the Senate passed unanimously on Friday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
A research paper published yesterday by U.S. and Canadian scientists says less sea ice in the Arctic has meant more precipitation is falling. Lead author Ben Kopeck of Dartmouth College says researchers looked at 20 years of precipitation data at sites in the Canadian Arctic and the Greenland Sea. They measured isotope compositions to determine whether moisture originated in the Arctic or from lower latitudes. They found that as sea ice diminished, more precipitation fell and more came from Arctic sources. The researchers conclude that when sea ice decreases by 100,000 square kilometers, more than 38,000 square miles, the percentage of local sourced moisture increased by 18% in the Canadian Arctic and 10.8% in the Greenland Sea. The authors conclude that a changed hydrologic cycle could be a major component of climate change. There really isn't any electronic music at the annual Alaska Folk Festival, but now there's a little folk fest in a Southeast duo's electronic music. KTOO's Annie Bartholomew explains.
Liz Snyder and Patrick Troll came up with the name Whiskey Class when filling out their application for the 2012 Alaska Folk Festival.
Whiskey Glass was a good name because it's like one of those punny band names where you know, like Whiskey Glass is a thing, but then if you change one letter, Whiskey Glass. Follow me, darling.
Try After their acoustic set at Folk Fest, the pair began incorporating layered vocals, drum loops, and ambient tones, entering the colorful world of electronic music. Before they were Whiskey Glass, they were teenage musicians from rival Southeast Alaska high schools. They found each other's music in the early days of social media, through MySpace and MSN Messenger. They still live apart, but make music together, and they're both musicians in their own rights. Snyder is half of the Juno folk rock duo, The Wool Pullers, and Troll creates beats as Ketchikan's DJ alternative. Living in different places forces them to collaborate over weekend-long recording sessions. Often it starts with Troll's beats and Snyder freestyling over them.
Sometimes it's the beat, sometimes we're just like sitting around and like messing around with something. I'm like, wait, let's record that. And then you loop it, put drums over it, and then you just like...
Basically we just record everything, and then
I force Liz to be a diva.
Yeah.
After their marathon recording sessions, Troll will edit and continue to polish the raw audio over weeks and months. Their new music video for the song Thirt is 2 years in the making. Snyder visited Troll when he was living in California's Humboldt County. That's when Troll reached out to friend and visual artist Ian Stewart, who'd been experimenting with green screens and digital animation. With cameras rolling, Whiskey Glass turned him loose to direct and shoot their first music video.
We had just finished the track like 5 minutes prior, so it was kind of fun to lip sync to a song I didn't really know.
The finished product is a psychedelic journey, with cartoon versions of the band drifting through Alaska landscapes and outer space, with a host of other random scenarios and subtle drug references.
You know, seeing yourself animated and like waiting so long, it's just like this epic moment, and I'm like watching it on my iPhone. And I texted him, I was just like, dude, you are insane. And he's like, yeah, sorry it took so long. Sorry it took 2 years. It's like, yeah. I mean, but that's kind of how like our music worked.
In addition to the video, the band dropped a new single this week, the jazzy and dreamlike Juice Man. One of their songs was featured in 2012's The Breach, a salmon conservation documentary, alongside animation by his dad, Ray Troll. Whiskey Glass plans to release an EP this spring, sometime around Folk Fest. But, like their music, the deadline's fluid. In Juneau, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
Striking a balance that provides ample living space for both humans and wild animals is not always easy. A biologist with the Department of Fish and Game talked with Homer residents last week about the methods wildlife managers use to keep the peace between people and brown bears. KBBI's Quentin Chandler reports.
Brown bears are considered a valuable natural resource on the peninsula. People love to hunt and view them. But it's well known that allowing too many bears near human populations is asking for trouble. Homer's Pratt Museum asked Kenai Peninsula Area Management biologist Jeff Selinger to discuss the Department of Fish and Game's management practices as part of their new bear exhibit. Selinger says Fish and Game aims for a happy medium when managing the bear population.
We want to always maintain healthy populations, but then we could go anywhere from kind of the bottom level of that to not harvesting any animals and just letting them do what they're going to do.
Peninsula residents' opinions are especially important because the Board of Game depends on the public to help them decide if the bear population should go up or down.
There's a lot of people that are still out there that think bears need to go down, be reduced even further. And you've got other people that think we should have more bears. So we're in that range somewhere. Exactly where that line is, I'm not positive at this point.
Fish and Game operates around strict management objectives set by the Board of Game for each wildlife population they oversee. This year's management objectives for brown bears are...
As far as hunting goes, is to not exceed 50 to 60 total are 8 to 12 adult female human-caused mortalities. Also, to maintain a healthy, viable population of brown bears for multiple uses, reduce the brown bear numbers around communities to minimize human-bear conflicts.
Selinger says human-bear conflicts are down because the population has been reduced in the past few years by more liberal hunting regulations. Right now, he says Fish and Game is focusing on keeping bear populations near communities at their current level.
I think people are more satisfied than what they had been, say, 5 years ago. We have harvest opportunities now that we never had before. People are able to take a bear that way rather than having to shoot bears with DLPs. We get a lot fewer complaints out of the Soldotna office regarding negative bear-human encounters.
Selinger says he doesn't need to know the actual number of brown bears to do his job.
We can learn from complaints, sightings, DLPs, the number of bears that are hit by vehicles. We use a lot of anecdotal information to determine where we are.
DLPs are wildlife kills in defense of life or property. Selinger says combining that anecdotal information and data collected through careful research is part of the art of being a manager.
Ideally, yeah, we would know the exact number. We would know how many reproductive sows. We would know every little bit of reproduction that occurs, the survivability of the survivorship rates of every different age class of bears. That would be, in a perfect world, you would have that, but we're far from that. And We gotta work with what we can get.
According to Selinger's presentation, 70 brown bears were killed by hunters in 2013. That's more bears than any year since 1961. But the number of bears killed outside of hunts fell by a lot in the last few years, resulting in less than 10 deaths this year and last year as well. Selinger attributes those numbers to liberalized hunting regulations, and he adds that more people are learning how to minimize the number of bear attractants in and around their homes. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lakeed Rashavis in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu and Annie Bartholomew in Juneau, Emily Russell in Nome, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Each December, there is a spike in impaired driving-related accidents. Consider the real costs of driving impaired. It could result in the loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office. If you are a rural Alaskan resident with a knowledge of regional fish and wildlife subsistence, you can apply for one of the 35 seats on your federal subsistence regional advisory councils. The council provides advice and recommendations on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing issues. Deadline to apply is Friday, January 29th, 2016. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.